Lecture 12, Ashoka's Imperial Buddhism.
In India, even today, the most famous and celebrated person from ancient history is Emperor Ashoka of the Mauryan dynasty. There are many reasons why he has been so extensively idealized. He ruled an empire that encompassed not only virtually all of the current Republic of India, but almost all of South Asia. This encourages those Indians who envision an undivided land as it stood prior to the 1947 partition of the subcontinent that carved out both Pakistan and what is now Bangladesh. Also, the only other empires to reach the same pan-Indian scale, even briefly, were ruled by outsiders. First that of the Delhi Sultans and then the Mughal emperors, both the result of Muslim invasions from the northwest. And then third, the British, who were Christian colonizers. In contrast, Ashoka's empire was indigenous to India. While Ashoka was a victorious conqueror, he later became known for his nonviolence and energetic benevolence as a ruler. In one of his edicts, he decreed that throughout his reign, sympathy, quote, should be felt for all creatures. Righteousness should be practiced. This is an ancient rule conducive to long life, unquote. Thus, although Ashoka identified as a Buddhist, which is not the religion of many people in India today, he has been claimed by the Indian government and society. An idealized model of Ashoka and his reign now appear in many places, including in official government history textbooks and in popular Bollywood cinema. In addition to his other accomplishments, Ashoka also left us very touchingly evocative first-person accounts of himself. He was the first ruler, and the only one for centuries to come, who so extensively and deliberately preserved his own words about the very personal spiritual journey that he went on. He had these words about his victories, but he also had words about the remorse at the deaths he had caused, carved on rock faces at the borders of his empire and on smoothly polished pillars that he had erected at key sites within his empire. Through them, we get a vital sense of the man himself, which is very rare for the 3rd century BCE in most places in the world. In previous lectures, we have surveyed how the complex culture, economy, society, and politics of Ashoka's world came about. There were roughly a dozen Indo-European languages, each in a separate region of North and Central India. Each of these was derived from Sanskrit, which remained the language of the elite, while each region developed its own popular language called a Prakrit. The most widespread of these Sanskrit-derived languages in the upper and middle Gangetic plain was Pali, the language used by Gautama the Buddha and later Buddhist scriptures. In South India, there were four other major languages, all part of the Dravidian language family. This north-south cultural distancing made a pan-Indian empire like that of Ashoka especially exceptional. Ashoka's Buddhism was just one of the major religions that emerged from these complex conditions. We have already seen that the Jain tradition also advocated nonviolence, although to a more absolute degree of asceticism, considered too extreme by Buddhists. Both Buddhism and Jainism appealed to the rising class of merchants who profited from enhanced commerce within each region, but also increasingly traded between regions and even intercontinentally. Also, the Brahmanic model of the four Varnas and many traditional Jatis was increasingly based on birth, which some people ranked lower than in those social orders found unsatisfactory. Ashoka inherited what had already become a multi-regional empire of a scale unprecedented in Indian history. You'll recall that Ashoka's grandfather, Emperor Chandragupta, had risen up to found their Mauryan dynasty as the ruler of the resource-rich North Indian region of Magadha. Chandragupta then conquered and allied with rulers of other regions until he reigned from Afghanistan in the west to Bengal in the east and across most of the Deccan highlands of central India. But Chandragupta's administration was relatively thin and weak compared to the one his grandson would build. We discussed in the previous lecture how and why Chandragupta evidently abdicated and starved himself to death in the ideal Jain way. Though Chandragupta's son and direct heir, Emperor Bindusara, left little evidence of his reign, a disordered interregnum seems to have followed. But by 269 BCE, Chandragupta's grandson, Ashoka, finally eliminated all of his rivals and controlled Magadha and its remaining subordinate provinces. During Ashoka's first 10 years of rule, he consolidated his power and developed the efficiency of his army and administration. One of his most effective measures appears to be his creation of the very first Indian system of writing, today called the Brahmi script. We have seen that India had a long tradition of preservation of information by memorization of orally conveyed bodies of knowledge. Most prominent among these is the Veda, parts of which have been preserved word perfect by recitation for 3,000 years until today. But a record of the exact words and decrees of an emperor who ruled 23 centuries ago stands as a particularly valuable source for historians. Scholars continue to debate where Ashoka took the elements of the Brahmi script from. The answer, whatever it proves to be, will also tell us much about the range of cultural links and influences between India and the West. At present, there are two leading theories about the source of Ashoka's Brahmi script. The first and earliest of these theories, developed mostly by European scholars, is that the Brahmi script developed from the Semitic script via Aramaic. There is much evidence that this had been the path of development of the Kharosthi script, a different script that Ashoka used on some of his inscriptions, but only along the western frontier of his empire. These scholars argue that since Ashoka knew about the existing script, he would have based his new Brahmi script on it. If this theory is accurate, then India was strongly influenced by Mediterranean-based cultures to the west. But other linguists, many of them based in India, object that Semitic and Aramaic scripts read from right to left, but Brahmi reads in the other direction. Now, Brahmi could have reversed its direction at an early point, and there is one surviving coin that seems to go in this other direction. But this evidence of a Semitic origin of the Brahmi script is not completely convincing. Further, it is difficult to show how the symbols used in Semitic and Aramaic writing could have evolved into those of Brahmi, which is very different in shape and what each shape represents in terms of vowels and consonants. Finally, Brahmi clearly has phonemics that match Indian languages like retroflex consonants, but that are not found in Semitic and Aramaic languages. The second main scholarly position is that Brahmi script came from Indian sources, which would please many Indians. One possible origin that some scholars point to is the Indus script, but that had over 400 symbols, perhaps pictograms, while Brahmi has only 36 characters, each based on a consonant with a vowel ending, a system linguists call Abhudra. In addition, the Indus script, as far as we can tell, reads right to left, unlike Brahmi. Nor do the Indus characters match those of Brahmi in shape. Another very plausible explanation for the first development of the Brahmi script is that Emperor Ashoka directed his officials to create it out of several existing sources already present in India. Having a system of writing was certainly very valuable, and it was a major improvement in his administration's effectiveness, since there is evidence that not even his grandfather, Chandragupta, used any system of writing at all. Especially given the expansion of trade and finance, merchants would likely have needed to use some way to preserve and convey information in writing. In this explanation, Ashok may have had his officials draw upon a system of record keeping then used by Indian merchants. Such an indigenous origin would especially please many Indians who came to identify with Ashok. Scholars of Sanskrit had for hundreds of years been developing theories about how that language worked. Most prominently, Panini had composed an oral but sophisticated study of the Sanskrit grammar in the 7th century BCE, hundreds of years earlier. Further, supporting the indigenous argument, the Brahmi script matches the sounds of popular Indic languages derived from Sanskrit, including Pali, the language of the Buddha's teaching, and most of Ashok's inscriptions. Over the following centuries, the Brahmi script clearly evolved into today's writing systems of both North Indian Sanskrit-derived languages and the four major South Indian Dravidian languages. However, these systems of writing have since changed so much that North Indian writing and South Indian writing look very different and are mutually illegible. Since Ashok's administration used the Brahmi script, they must have also had something to write it on. Thousands of years earlier, Egyptians had flattened a particular kind of marsh reed into papyrus. This paper-like substance proved highly useful, but no such reeds grew in India. The Mesopotamian and Indus cultures had pressed their writing into clay, but no evidence of such clay records have survived to indicate that Ashok's empire did that too. At roughly the same time as Emperor Ashok, the Chinese invented something close to what we know as paper today. But this technology did not spread to India for many centuries. Instead, the most common technique in India was to use a flattened palm leaf. So probably Ashok's administration used that, or wrote on wood, cloth, or leather. But all of these are very perishable, and so no actual records on those materials have survived from his reign. Instead, all of the surviving Ashokan writings were carved on polished rocks and on stone pillars. Although weathered and eroded, these have lasted for more than 2,300 years. However, their meaning had been lost for most of that period. The Brahmi script continued to develop so that a few centuries later, no one alive could read it in this, the oldest form. Generally, ancient, long-forgotten scripts can be deciphered when they appear along with the same message written in other scripts that we do know how to read. With Egyptian hieroglyphs, for example, this was possible because of the famous Rosetta Stone, which had the same text in three different scripts, including an early form of Greek writing that scholars already knew. After much effort, the hieroglyphs on the Rosetta Stone were finally deciphered in the early 19th century. Very soon after that, the scripts of Ashok's writing were also decoded. Bilingual coins from a later Indo-Greek ruler enabled a British chemist, antiquarian, and orientalist in India, James Prinsep, to decipher Kharosthi, the other script used by Ashok, and from that to decipher the Brahmi script. But even when read, these ancient texts did not yet enable historians to identify their author or dates. The inscriptions speak of King Beloved of the Gods, but there were no other sources that showed who that was or when he ruled. There were no dates in the inscriptions, except that some give the number of years into his reign that they were written. For example, they start about 10 years after his accession. Only after scholars realized that this Beloved of the Gods was the epithet or title that Emperor Ashok Maurya used for himself could we study these ancient inscriptions to understand his reign and him as a person. According to Emperor Ashok's own chronology in the inscriptions, 8 years after he gained the throne, he led his armies to victory in an especially brutal and bloody war. The enemy was a land called Kalinga, which we call Orissa province in eastern India today. That land borders the Bay of Bengal, but becomes hilly and forested in the interior. Then, as now, many Adivasis lived in those forested interior hills. Kalinga was near Magadha, So it must have been especially resistant and a fierce holdout against the Mauryan Empire to remain unconquered for so long. As Ashoka himself recalls, this war of conquest brought his armies into killing 100,000 local people, deporting or enslaving 150,000 more, and even vaster numbers died from the devastation of the region. While these specific figures are probably not exact, the massive violence that Ashoka inflicted shocked even him into reconsidering his entire role as emperor and in life. He later recorded that he, quote, regrets the conquest of Kalinga. When an independent country is conquered, the people are killed or are deported. And that the beloved of the gods finds very painful and grievous, unquote. He came to realize that all unjust violence is wrong, going on to proclaim, quote, even if the number of those killed and captured in the conquest of Kalinga had been 100 or 1,000 times less, it would have been grievous to the beloved of the gods. As a result of this horrific war, Ashoka began to turn to Buddhism. In another inscription, Ashoka also credits one of his most charitable queens, Karavaki, who, he says, guided him toward the Buddhist path. It is clear that Ashoka thought deeply about how to become the ideal emperor according to the Buddhist model of the universal emperor, the Lord of the Four Quarters, who triumphs not by warfare, but through the power of the symbolic wheel of Dhamma, Buddhist righteousness and morality. Becoming a Buddhist while ruling a vast empire, however, had to be a gradual process. Ashoka recorded how difficult it was for him, writing, quote, at first I did not make much progress, unquote. It was even more difficult for him to make his imperial household completely vegetarian. He writes, quote, formerly in the beloved of the gods' kitchen, several 100,000 animals were killed daily for food. But now, at the time of writing, only 3 are killed, 2 peacocks and a deer, though the deer not regularly. Even those 3 animals will not be killed in the future, end quote. In his inscriptions, Ashoka also reveals his understanding of what being a Buddhist emperor meant. None of his edicts discusses the more abstract, theological, or cosmological features of that religion. Perhaps he was simplifying the message for his people, using the Buddhist tactic of appropriate teaching up to the level of complexity that the student is capable of understanding. For whatever reason, he does not discuss the transcendent goal of Buddhism called nirvana. Instead, he repeatedly asserts that all those who follow the Buddhist Dhamma will be reborn in heaven. For him, as a Buddhist emperor, that Dhamma meant protecting the poor and weak, the slaves and servants among his subjects. He ordered his governors to implement uniform, impartial, and predictable administration and regulations. Officials must not act arbitrarily or impulsively or selfishly. In particular, for the officials governing the shattered region of Kalinga, he gave special instructions, publicly available for anyone to see, that the devastated people should be reconciled and won over into affection for Ashoka. He also made Dhauli, the site of the bloodiest battle of his conquest, into a center where monks, nuns, and other Buddhists could assemble and pray. It was even more difficult to make all the people of his empire follow the Buddhist Dhamma of nonviolence. Ashoka tried diligently to convince them that Buddhism was more virtuous and effective than other religions, including Jainism, that had been followed by his grandfather, and the Brahmanic Vedic tradition that was followed by the vast majority of his subjects. He created a ministry of Dhamma and sent out state officials as missionaries to persuade people to follow Dhamma. Some of these missionaries, he asserted, went as far south as Sri Lanka, where the Sinhala-speaking people largely converted to Buddhism soon after. Today, Sinhala Buddhists make up about 80% of the population there. Ashoka also sent his agents as far west as Greece and Egypt, bearing not only the message of Buddhism, but also special medicinal herbs and other plants from India, thus contributing to their spiritual and physical health. But Ashoka did not outlaw other religious beliefs and practices of his subjects. In several of his edicts, he explains that customary domestic ceremonies done on the occasions of weddings, births, and setting out on journeys, which were especially done by women, are, quote, futile and useless. In contrast, Buddhist ceremonies of Dhamma, he proclaims, are effective in this world and the next. He did ban Brahmanic Vedic animal sacrifices in his capital, although he evidently could not forbid it outside of this capital. Further, Ashoka asserts that all true religions agree that, quote, concord is best with each hearing and respecting the other's teachings. Ashoka performed the Buddhist duty of dana, giving, to the Buddhist Sangha of monks and nuns. He also gave charity to Brahmin and Jain teachers and ascetics. Instead of going out on animal hunting expeditions, as did his predecessor kings, Ashoka says that on his expeditions into the countryside, quote, he interviews the people of the provinces and instructs and questions them on righteousness. And the pleasure which the beloved of the god derives therefrom is as good as a second revenue, in addition to tax money. Since Ashoka and even his officials could not be everywhere in his vast empire, he ordered his decrees inscribed on many smoothly polished rock faces and on stone columns publicly available for anyone who was literate to read and to others to hear read out loud. Ashoka clearly wanted the local people to be able to read and understand these inscriptions. For example, several of the rock inscriptions west of the Indus River are in Aramaic and Greek, written in the Kharosthi script, or in Aramaic or Greek scripts used there. By plotting the location of each site of his surviving rock inscriptions, we can see an outline of the extent of his empire. Almost all of South Asia, except the very southern tip, seems to have recognized his sovereignty, however distantly, when merchants, immigrants, or travelers entered his empire, they would encounter his inscribed declaration that this was a land where Buddhist principles reigned. This showed that he envisioned his empire as a territorial one with demarcated borders. Many earlier rulers had seen themselves ruling a particular community of people, not a particular land. Ashoka also ordered a sandstone quarry at Chunar near Benares to carve out many 40-foot-long pillars, each weighing up to 50 tons. These massive columns were transported by animal-drawn carts for hundreds of miles to key sites within his empire, polished smooth and inscribed with its edicts. They had capitals of a carved lotus with an inverted petals, the lotus being a widely used symbol in India of purity, since that plant grows pristine, even if its surrounding pond is mucky. Some columns are topped with a four-headed lion, which looks in all directions, as a ruler should. This has become a major national symbol of today's Republic of India, appearing on government seals and emblazoned on its coins and banknotes. As we have seen, many Buddhists revered the ashes and other relics of the Buddha and of saintly Buddhist teachers, installing them in stupas or flattened conical structures, often surmounted by the umbrella of sovereignty. Emperor Ashoka collected as many of these sacred relics as agents were able to obtain and built many of the most impressive stupas to house and protect them. The stupa at Sanchi near Benares is particularly prominent even today. Further, Ashoka is credited with organizing and systematizing Buddhism. Around 250 BCE, he called to his imperial capital all of the major Buddhist leaders for what would be the third great Buddhist council. There, they codified the Buddhist canon in the Pali language and established doctrinal boundaries, meaning that some heterodox sects were declared non-Buddhist. While Ashoka repeated his personal and official commitment to Buddhism, he was still a ruler of a vast empire. He advocated for peaceful obedience from his subjects, but should any oppose him, he promised severe punishment. He vowed to protect the trees and animals of the forest that still made up a sizable part of his realm. But should any Adivasis destroy these imperial trees or kill any of its animals, he warns, quote, that there is power even in the remorse of the beloved of the gods, and he tells them to reform lest they be killed. To foster commerce as well as the movement of his officials and armies, Ashoka constructed roads across his vast empire. Along these, he ordered that shady trees and mango fruit groves be planted and that refreshing ponds and wells be dug along them. Nevertheless, communication and the movement of officials and armies remained relatively slow. Controlling so much and so many diverse regions and cultures over such a vast distance has historically proven very difficult for empires in South Asia. And the Mauryan Empire was the first empire of a pan-Indian scale. While Ashoka seems to have directly governed the region around his imperial capital, Pataliputra, he sent out at least three and perhaps more relatively autonomous governors to administer the empire's more distant provinces. He decreed, quote, "that they may fearlessly carry out their duties. I have given the power to judge and to inflict punishment on their own initiative," unquote. Some of these governors may have been members of the imperial family. This meant that Ashoka ruled a patrimonial state where the ruler's personal household was the core of the government, where there was no distinction between his personal wealth and the state's treasury, and where his sons and other relatives were also the governors and commanders. As Ashoka put it, quote, "all men are my children, and as I wish all welfare and happiness in the world and the next for my own children, so do I wish it for all men." But governors and officials did not always follow his directives. He admitted, quote, "here and there an officer may understand in part, but not entirely. Often a man is imprisoned and tortured unjustly, and then he is liberated for no apparent reason. Many other people suffer also as a result of this injustice," unquote. Hence, Ashoka publicly ordered his governors and other officials, quote, "therefore it is desirable that you should practice impartiality, but it cannot be attained if you are inclined to habits of jealousy, irritability, harshness, hastiness, obstinacy, laziness, or lassitude. I desire you not to have these habits." Ashoka determined to make his regime and its principles eternal, writing, quote, "I have done this that it may endure as long as the moon and the sun, and that my sons and my great-grandsons may support it. For by supporting it, they will gain both this world and the next." But this was beyond Ashoka's power to accomplish. Instead, his dynasty only lasted 5 decades after his death. There were many reasons for the rapid decline of the Mauryan Empire. Such a patrimonial state needed an exceptionally strong leader, like Ashoka. But evidently, none of his Mauryan heirs could rise to his level of power or authority. The technology available to the imperial administration had been overstretched. For instance, the slow communications and implementation of orders over such a vast territory was hard. Taxes no longer flowed to the imperial capital and the emperor's treasury. Instead, various governors asserted their own autonomy from the imperial center, keeping local revenues and establishing their own regimes. Further, the strongly distinct identities of India's historical regions based on language and on social and economic bonds reemerged from under the Ashokan umbrella and reasserted themselves. The glue of Buddhism that Ashoka had tried to use to hold together his universal imperium could not withstand the pull of more regionally grounded Brahmanic traditions. Therefore, although some Mauryan successors held on to a rump kingdom for 50 years after Ashoka's death, a Brahmin imperial general assassinated and displaced the last weak Mauryan king around 187 BCE and founded his own Shunga Brahmin dynasty in Magadha. The cultural significance of Emperor Ashoka, however, has long continued in Indian history. As we'll see in the next lectures, various rulers in each of the major regions of the Indian subcontinent looked to Ashoka as the ideal model of a Buddhist emperor that they tried in vain to emulate.